Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 08-3060, United States of America versus Michael Anthony Battle, appellant. Mr. Sussman for the appellant, Ms. Park for the appellee.
Morning, Your Honor.
Morning.
For the court's information, I'm going to submit on the second and third arguments in the brief, and confine my time to the first argument, the question of Mr. Battle's competency. Let me begin. Michael Battle, facing charges that carried a mandatory minimum of at least 10 years and potential life sentences, refused to cooperate with his attorney, pronouncing that the result was ordained. He did nothing to help himself. He put his trust in God and waited for judgment day. Not surprisingly, a Bureau of Prison psychologist who never observed his interaction with counsel and never spoke with Mr. Battle concerning his religious views, and even found it normal that Battle's experiencing of blackouts during religious moments, found that to be a normal phenomenon, concluded that the appellant was not delusional and suffered from no mental disease or defect. It's clear in this case that the defendant's understanding of the process, understanding of the charges, was not at issue. The sole issue in this case was whether Mr. Battle could meaningfully cooperate with his lawyer. His attorney in this case, an extremely experienced lawyer who had handled perhaps thousands of cases, found that Mr. Battle could not cooperate with her and asked for a private evaluation. This was done by an extremely experienced psychologist who had done numerous evaluations, worked for many government agencies, NASA and others, who interpreted the psychological testing and interviewed Mr. Battle himself, watched Mr. Battle interact with his attorney, and concluded that based on all the data that Mr. Battle was delusional, that he was paranoid and perhaps schizophrenia, and totally unable to deal with his attorney in a meaningful way. It is clear on the record that Mr. Battle was not malingering. Mr. Battle at all times protested the competency evaluations, claimed he was competent. Significantly, when he was first evaluated by the Bureau of Prisons, they found him malingering under what was clear evidence that he was not. The prison psychologist eventually changed his opinion and agreed that there was no malingering in this case, that Mr. Battle was trying to be found competent, and that was his desire, and I think that's a significant point, and the change of position by the prison psychologist is equally significant. In a evidentiary hearing, a somewhat protracted evidentiary...
Yes, it's a question of which way it cuts. I mean, it indicates that Dr. Chanel was open to new argument and evidence.
Well, it certainly does that, but that was about the only thing that Dr. Chanel found to be favorable to the appellant's position. Every other interpretation, every other nuance, every other evidentiary inference was spun by Dr. Chanel in a way that that cut against the determination of non-competency. I think I've gone through and recited many of the factual findings. If Mr. Battle...
pause on that question. Is our standard of review, everybody agrees, is clear error? Is that right?
That would be clearly erroneous on the findings, and abuse of discretion is the general standard. And I think that the most significant factor in this analysis is this case combines two very difficult issues. It's a societal view of religiosity coupled with the working...
What kind of view?
So, I think that the court...
Societal view?
That's correct.
The adjective.
That was correct. Somewhere along the continuum of religiosity, of people's attitude toward religion, predeterminism, there comes a point where normal religiosity ends and delusion begins. And I think that in the district court's analysis, that was never considered. And I think that's the principal problem in this consideration. Mr. Battle took a totally predetermined view of of the situation. It was as if there was no point in cooperating, no point in participating with his counsel, no point in planning. The outcome was preordained. It was God's hand would deliver him in some fashion, and whatever God willed in this case would be the result. Clearly.
Mr. Sussman, doesn't there have to be a mental disease or defect? It can't just be one's belief. Or is your position that anybody who believes in predeterminism has a mental defect?
No, that is not my position.
So there has to be. You place an awful lot of emphasis on the religious views, but the statute says the defendant has to be suffering from a mental disease or defect.
Delusion is a diagnostic defect under the DSM.
Right, but the government's experts are competent to determine whether the person is delusional or not.
That's part of it. The question of whether you're delusional in a religious situation, I think, many people have extreme religious views. Many people believe outcomes are determined. And historically, you can document numerous people who've achieved great things who take that view. Almost singularly, they also adopt the view that that God helps those who help themselves. There is simply no one that you can point to who just, for example, George Washington believed in predeterminism.
Well, I think we're getting outside the record.
No, I think that's significant, though.
Do we know Mr. Battle's position on whether
do nothing?
God lends a hand to those who help themselves?
Well, this was the question. I mean, I can dispute all the findings, and I believe that they were skewed findings. What I think is central to this is the notion, you start from a point that where someone's religious beliefs, and the state does this all the time. The state does this in many contexts where the state's interests trump one's religious views. If one believes that a child will be healed by the hand of God, the state will intercede if medical evidence suggests otherwise. Religiosity is certainly not a defense to violations of laws, and we see that all the time. What is different about this context? This is a fundamental constitutional right. It's a Sixth Amendment right. It's a due process right. This is why we're making the inquiry. The DSM defines delusion as a thought process that cannot be changed no matter what the realities one confronts, that one adheres to in the face of any evidence that one sees. And this was exactly what Mr. Battle was doing. Now, there's certainly evidence that produced by the appellant in the court below that there was a paranoid thinking, there was he regarded a routine hospital blood test as medical experimentation. Dr. Chanel thought, well, this was nothing unusual. He was tired of being there, and he didn't want to submit to a further test on one of his last days at the hospital. That doesn't seem to be a very good explanation for why someone would call a routine blood test medical experimentation.
There are people in this country who have what to me are very extreme views of that sort. And I guess in common parlance we may throw the word paranoid around about them, but not as a technical judgment.
Well, I'm sorry. In this case, that judgment was made by Dr. Muldaur, who looked at the testing result.
But not by Dr. Chanel.
No. Dr. Muldaur looked at the testing result. He sent the tests, the MMPI test, to an accredited, well-known scoring service. He did not score them himself. He sent them to somebody who does that professionally. Dr. Chanel just said that the absence of answers and conflicting answers to some of the questions totally invalidated the test, and he refused to look at the result, and the result had no meaning to him. The judge...
Well, that's a professional judgment. If somebody doesn't answer a large percentage of the questions or answers both yes and no to a large percentage of the questions, it doesn't seem beyond the pale of Chanel's professional competence to say that this test is no longer an accurate reflection of his mental state. Why is that wrong?
The test consisted of approximately 600 questions. Yeah. Battle answered approximately 510 or 505 of these questions, and at some point, I don't think it's unusual for someone with mental disease, mental defect, some kind of mental disorder, to have difficulty maintaining the focus.
No, but when you say that you don't think that, you're also not a credentialed psychologist. You have one person who is on one side, one who isn't on the other side. You're saying that approximately one-sixth of the questions weren't answered.
That's the ratio. Well, they were answered yes,
like
no.
Like a pretty large. Sorry.
They were answered yes and no.
Yes. Well, that seems like you're suggesting that was just a few out of the total. That seems like a very large amount.
No, I gave the number, and that was and that occurrence was observed and taken into account in the test scoring by the scoring company, and they gave that a weight and a balance, and they factored that in, and so did Dr. Muldaur. This was tests that indicated paranoid thinking, indicated potential schizophrenia, indicated severe mental disease. Aside from just the delusional thinking about having no effect on outcome and having no, if Mr. Battle had taken the view that the result of this criminal case was in Providence's hands, and then cooperated with his attorney, that would have been a fairly insignificant legal position on his part, and that's not an unusual view. But the failure to cooperate is indicative of a delusional thinking that this process will go on and end successfully despite what you do or what you don't do. I mean, that's something more than fatalistic, especially when it's accompanied by this kind of clear evidentiary support concerning blackouts, concerning discussions about being messenger of God, that it was the religious orientation, the delusion in what would happen that made him incompetent to stand trial. Now, the incompetency is not necessarily a permanent position or something, as Dr. Muldaur said, it's always in flux, and it's something that changes from time to time. And it might have changed, and it could have changed in the future. But in the present, Mr. Battle went to trial with severe mental delusion, and that compromised his right to due process rights and his right to counsel.
Okay, other questions? No. Ms. Park? Thank you, Mr. Sussman.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Ann Park on behalf of the United States. I will also address only the competency claim and submit on the briefs with respect to appellant sufficiency claims, unless, of course, the Court has questions. The District Court did not clearly err in crediting the government's expert over the defense expert and finding appellant competent to stand trial. And this is because Dr. Channel's opinion that appellant's uncooperative behavior was volitional and not the result of a mental defect or disease that rendered him unable to assist his counsel in preparing his defense was well supported by the record. Dr. Channel and his staff at Devens had an ample opportunity to observe appellant during appellant's two-month stays at Devens. And during this time, the staff and Dr. Channel did not observe or see any signs that the defendant had any signs indicating that he had paranoia, schizophrenia, or any other delusional disorder. Moreover, Dr. Channel administered competency tests that really were not disputed. I'm talking about the ECST-R, ECST-R below, and these tests indicated that appellant was well able to rationally assist his attorney in preparing his defense. Appellant also had no history of mental illness or treatment, despite Dr. Channel's efforts to find a past history of mental illness. And importantly, the District Court's own observations of appellant during the course of the proceedings, the District Court made a finding that appellant appeared controlled, appropriate, and responsive throughout the competency proceedings. There's also no evidence in the record during trial that appellant had any disruptive behavior or that he was not cooperating with counsel or that there are any inappropriate outbursts by the defendant. And in fact, the one time the defendant is talking on the record at the trial, it's when the District Court is inquiring whether he wishes to testify or not. And the defendant says, you know, I'm happy, or I'm paraphrasing him, but he basically says, I'm happy with what Ms. D'Antuono has done with the government's witnesses and presentation of the evidence, so there's no need for me to testify.
Where is that?
if I can, if you could just give me a moment, Your Honor. Appellant stated there shouldn't be a need for him to testify, and that's at 4908 transcript, pages 85 to 86.
85 to 86. The competency hearing was before. Was there any kind of reconsideration afterwards as
yes.
a consequence of the trial?
During jury selection, Ms. D'Antono moved to renew her request, and she said, Your Honor, the defendant is refusing to work with me.
Well, that is, you said there was no evidence that there was no evidence that during the trial of inability to work together, and here you're saying that counsel for the defendant said that there was.
Yes, I apologize, Your Honor. I meant there's no, I was talking about any sort of affirmative outburst behavior on the defendant's part where he was on the record and speaking. Mm-hmm. And there's a footnote in our brief where I do point out that during the jury selection, defense counsel does renew her request. And if you read the court's finding, he says, based on my observations, interaction with him, and he talks about how the other day he went through the plea, and there's a transcript of a motions hearing, a pretrial hearing, and during that time, there's ex parte conversations between the defense counsel and the court. Of course, I don't know what they say, but based on what occurs after, it appears that they're discussing, the court goes over the plea offer at great length with the defendant. He goes over some of the evidence with the defendant, some of the consequences of a conviction if he went to trial. And at the end of it, he asks the defendant, do you want to plead guilty? And the defendant says adamantly, I do not. He rejects the plea offer. And I believe the defense counsel her motion is based on the fact that the defendant, and this is a concern of hers throughout, that he didn't appreciate the significance of the evidence against him. And she thought the government's case was strong and wanted the defendant to plead guilty, and he was going against her wishes. And so that seems like the basis of the renewed request during jury selection. There's also a snippet, which I didn't point out in my brief, and when I was reviewing the transcript, during jury selection, the court notes for the record that the defendant isn't wearing his headphones while they're at the bench doing voir dire. He decided not to wear those headphones to listen to the conversation that was occurring at the bench. And Ms. D'Antono then says, Your Honor, I'd like to put on the record as well that he's refusing to work with me. And so that was another reference, I think, that I didn't point out, but it's on page 33 of the April 3rd, 08 transcript. Those are the only that I could find references, the three that I mentioned during the trial. Otherwise, there's nothing to indicate that any problems or further problems with the relationship between defense counsel and the defendant, or that the defendant appeared bizarre, inappropriate. And with respect to appellant's counsel's claim that Dr. Channel changed his position with respect to malingering, at page 7 of the government's record material, there is Dr. Channel's first report. And when he discusses the psychological test results, he mainly states, the validity indices of the MMPI-2 indicated the defendant exaggerated his mental health symptoms in a manner consistent with malingering. He endorsed a number of items which are infrequently identified by both mental health inpatients and the MMPI-2 normative sample. That's the only thing the test says about, or Dr. Channel's report says about malingering. And Dr. Muldauner's testimony was quick to note that in the diagnoses section of Dr. Channel's report, he didn't diagnose the defendant with malingering. And it's true that the F scale was elevated and the FP scale, which are the scales that look at whether someone is faking bad, that is whether someone is presenting or saying that they have mental health problems when they actually don't. And those validity scales were elevated. So Dr. Channel was just remarking on the fact that they were elevated. But he stated in no uncertain terms in his opinion, in his testimony, that he did not believe, based on his own observations of the appellant, that the defendant was malingering. And with respect to the religious views, the trial court, in its factual findings, it credited Dr. Or it noted that the defendant was able to control his religious views. That is, in the second interviews with Dr. Channel and Dr. Muldaur, the defendant refused to talk about his religious views. He merely said, they're important to me and I don't want to talk about them anymore. And the court found that this cut against the idea that he had any sort of delusional disorder. Given the fact that here we just have a trial court listening to two sides, listening to both experts, weighing the evidence, crediting the government's evidence over the defense evidence, there is no clear error in this case, and we ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed, with the exception of the merger issue that we note in our footnote in our brief.
Just on the disposition on the merger issue, so could you just say a little bit more about what an opinion should say with respect to that?
Yes. We would ask that. Let me go to our brief specifically so I don't.
The sentence on one of the counts should be vacated.
Yes. We would like the court to vacate the distribution of crack cocaine count and remand for entry of judgment with respect to the distribution of crack within a drug-free zone or within 1,000 feet of
the. And the sentences were concurrent, right?
Yes, the sentences were concurrent. They're 135 months concurrent.
So a judgment's already been entered on the other one?
Yes, yes.
So.
Vacate the distribution of crack cocaine, yes. And I guess you would leave the school zone conviction.
Remand for further proceedings.
Yes. And there's no need for resentencing because there's concurrent sentences.
Okay. Thank you. Does Mr. Sussman have any time? So I'll give you another couple minutes. Mr. Sussman, on this merger issue, you're on board with that, right?
That's right.
Okay.
The thing that I think I think the court should notice that why is there any expectation that Mr. Battle would act out in court? I mean, that wasn't the issue. Acting out in court has more to do with an understanding of the proceedings. If one understands the proceedings, one understands that kind of behavior is not appropriate, not tolerated, and his actions were in conformity with that. And most of the observations of the court in terms of his demeanor in court are really irrelevant to the consideration of whether he's willing to.
Wouldn't the inability to work with counsel at least be reasonably expected to manifest itself? Apparently, was manifested on two occasions, and I take it you don't argue that it was manifested on further occasions.
It was replete throughout the case, and there was Ms. D'Antuono's constant complaint that her client, while facing these, extremely serious charges, was just not cooperative, not helping her in any way, not talking to her about the situation. It's kind of interesting to note that in terms of Dr. Chanel's findings, one of the things that he finds is that Mr. and it's finding it was finding 24 in the district court's findings that something that was not really opposed that the defendant had the ability to understand and the consequences of the pending criminal charges. This was a man facing mandatory minimums of 10 years and talking about halfway house time. So his own discussions with the defendant seemed to cut against the real realities of Mr. Battle's situation.
Well, given what he said, that he understood the nature of the proceedings.
Pardon?
I thought you conceded that.
Oh, we did. But I think that a lot of this, what you've been talking about in terms of Mr. Battle's demeanor, it has to do with the understanding of the proceedings. It is really not the issue, the central issue in the case. He understood what was going on in that respect, and he acted appropriately, except with his counsel. And that's the central issue, that he went to trial without cooperating with counsel and based on delusional thinking.
Well, can we just pause over one second here? Is your argument is back with what you just said before, is the brunt of this argument that he should have pled and that he...
No, that's a perfectly reasonable choice.
No, but when you say that what his counsel was really concerned with was that he wasn't cooperating with her recommendation to plead?
That can't be a complaint. Clients routinely reject attorneys' views. The problem is the actual cooperation, the discussion of the facts, the discussion of what occurred. Those kinds of considerations are what's paramount in the attorney-client relationship.
Thank you, Mr. Sussman. Sure. Mr. Sussman, you were appointed by the court to represent the appellant. The court thanks you for your assistance.
Thank you, sir.